Good morning, everybody. We are back on the record in Public Service Commission case number RC-13-850. This is the continuation of the formal hearing in this case that began on December 19th, 2014. I believe when we last left off that, Mr. Broughton, you had completed your case. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And next up will be Mr. Biella. I guess just before we get started, are there any preliminary matters that we should address before getting into Coyote Creek's portion of the case? Mr. Broughton, do you have anything?
I don't think so.
Okay. Mr. Biella?
No, Your Honor.
All right. And commissioners, any comments before we get started? Mr. Commissioner Chrisman?
Well, a question for you.
Sure.
Still not sure exactly what would be typical in a case like this, but do we have kind of a schedule of who's going to testify? Because, I mean, I've certainly put together a lot of questions based on what I heard the first 2 days, but I'm kind of guessing as to who they're for because I don't know.
Well, I don't have witness lists, but the order now will be Coyote Creek will call each of its witnesses, and they'll be subject to examination in the same manner as Mr. Broughton's witnesses were, and then followed up by Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle's case, and she will call her witnesses, and it'll be conducted in the same manner. I guess I don't know who each of the witnesses are.
Okay.
So
I have no other comments.
Okay. So. Commissioner Fedorchak?
Yeah. Good morning, everybody, and Happy New Year. Haven't heard from you guys since last year. I think it would be helpful at the start of each of the cases this morning if you can lay out who you plan to have and what you expect them to address. Typically, in some of our hearings, people do that, and it is helpful for us to know who to direct our questions at, and it might save the first witness from being bombarded with a bunch of questions they aren't prepared for. So if that's possible, I think that kind of gets to what Randy's saying, and I think that's helpful as well.
Sure.
Otherwise, I don't have anything else this morning.
Okay. Commissioner Kalk?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Biella, you can proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, just to identify our witnesses, we are going to have four witnesses this morning. The first one is Mr. Jim Melchior. He's a former land manager of North American Coal and the current president of Coyote Creek Mining Company. Our second witness will be Mr. Dave Bickel, B-I-C-K-E-L. He's the person who prepared the Alluvial Valley Floor Determination Report for Coyote Creek. The third witness will be Mr. Don Steffen. It's spelled D-O-N-N-S-T-E-F-F-E-N. He is the environmental manager for Coyote Creek Mining Company. He will just testify very briefly on his experience with reclamation. And the last witness is Ms. Sarah Flath with Coyote Creek. She is a environmental specialist and range specialist. Those will be our four witnesses. She will testify primarily as to the PSC's reclamation standards and how those are implemented by the company in preparing its application, and then when reclamation does come about, actually implementing them.
Okay. And you can call your first witness.
We'll call Mr. Jim Melchior.
Mr. Melchior, before you testify, I'm required to give you an oath, and I need to advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It's a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. And being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Biella.
Jim, please state your name and business address.
James Melchior. Business address is 6502 17th Street Southwest, Zapp, North Dakota.
And Jim, where were you born and raised?
I was born in Richardson, North Dakota, and raised on a farm and ranch just 7 miles south of there.
And what is your position with Coyote Creek Mining Company?
The president.
And prior to your appointment as president, what was your position at North American Coal Corporation?
Land manager.
And how long did you serve in that position?
I worked in for North American Coal's land office for about 39 years, and about 35 of those I was manager.
And was one of your duties as land manager negotiating coal leases?
Yes.
And did you negotiate the coal lease with Julie and Casey Voigt?
Yes.
And were the Voigts represented by an attorney in negotiation of this coal lease?
Yes.
And were you present with the Voigts and their attorney when they signed the coal lease?
Yes.
This is Exhibit 1, the coal lease. Showing you what is marked as Exhibit 1, is this a copy of the coal lease that was signed by the Voigts?
Yes, it is.
And under the terms of the coal lease, will the Voigts be compensated for loss of agricultural production while their lands are being used for mining operations?
Yes, they will.
And could you please just briefly summarize the terms of the coal lease to provide for the compensation for the loss of agricultural production?
Yes, I can. There's two sections in the surface and coal lease agreement that provide for the loss of agricultural production. The first section is in Section 3. Section 3 provides, in addition to a coal royalty, a surface royalty payment per ton for all coal mined from any of the Voigt's land. And then in section 8. The second paragraph provides for an annual payment based on the loss of net income for any portion of the surface used before the commencement of actual coal removal operations and for any portion of the surface used after coal removal operations to facilitate mining on other lands. The amount of the lost income payments are to be determined annually by mutual agreement of the Voigts and Coyote Creek based on net income generated from similar lands that he owns that are undisturbed.
And was this method for this compensation negotiated and agreed to by both parties?
Yes.
And when you were negotiating the terms of the coal lease with the Voigts and their attorney, did you tell them why North American Coal was acquiring the coal lease?
Yes. The Voigts were informed and other landowners in the area that North American Coal was acquiring the leases in that area to have coal in the event North American Coal was successful in getting the contract to supply coal to the Coyote Station.
Now, during Mr. Voigt's testimony, he referred to discussions of a land swap as being a distraction created by the company to prevent him from providing comments during the public comment period for the Coyote Creek application. Can you briefly describe how and when the discussions began and how the timing of that compares to the public comment period for the Coyote Creek application?
Yes, I can. Based on the documentation we have, the Voigts were notified by the Public Service Commission by notice dated March 26th of 2014 that they could submit written comments, objections, or request an informal hearing related to the application until May 19th. Of 2014. Mr. Voigt telephoned me on May 13th, which is about 6 days before that deadline, and said that he had found a ranch near Braddock that he requested that Coyote Creek purchase and trade to him for his land. The request itself came as somewhat of a surprise to us, as they'd given no previous indications that they wanted to sell their ranch, nor did we give any indications that we wanted to buy it.
So if I understand correctly, the Voigts had from March 26 to May 19 to submit comments, but that Mr. Voigt called you just 6 days before the deadline to request a land swap. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And was that the first time you'd ever discussed a land swap with Mr. Voigt?
Yes.
And so do you deny the accusation that Coyote Creek created the land swap as a distraction and delayed discussions to prevent him from providing comments during the public comment period?
Yes, that's not true.
I have no further questions of Mr. Melchior.
Mr. Broughton, you can cross-examine the witness.
Mr. Melchior, do you recall a meeting with Mr. Voigt on August 27, 2013, at which you instructed him to look for land for a potential land swap?
No, I do not.
I'm going to direct your attention back to paragraph 8 of Exhibit 1. And this is the paragraph that you indicated allowed for surface damages to be paid to Mr. Voigt. Is that correct?
Yes, as one of them. The other section was Section 3.
Sure. And the language states that after completion of coal removal operations, if lessee uses all or any portion of the surface, it'll pay lessor amount equal to the net income lost by lessor. After land is released from bond, is the coal company going to be using that land for its coal removal operations?
After it's released from bond, the company can't use the lands anymore. They have to be fully reclaimed and meet the PSC standards. So we wouldn't be able to use the property at all.
And so if Mr. Voigt had any losses to his income as a result of productivity issues after bond release, you would not be compensating him for that under the lease?
Well, if the land didn't meet the productivity standards that existed before, it wouldn't be released from bond.
But if Mr. Voigt did have problems with productivity post-bond release, it's not something that you would compensate him for under the coal lease?
Not if the coal lease had expired, no.
If the coal lease hadn't expired?
Then we would need to visit about it, I guess. But if it's released from bond, there's no obligation for us to pay agricultural losses.
Okay. No further questions?
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
We have no questions.
Okay. Commissioner Chrisman?
The first day of the hearing, Mr. Voigt talked about concern about limiting public access to lands way, way before they're going to be mined. Can you address that? And as I look at the map that I seen, you know, I don't look for your answer to be so detailed, but like specifically the land on the mine map west of County 13, it looks like that is maybe all a decade or more away. So how do you handle that land that's way out?
Yeah, there. The signs that we posted were obligated to post the limits of the mining permit. Now, the signs that were put up, my understanding was they had no trespassing language on them, which is typical at our operations that we put that type of language on our permit identification signs. But in this case, being it's a long ways from where we're starting, they probably shouldn't have been put on, and I think we've removed that language off the bottom of those signs, or will be. But the permit signs, we have to mark the boundaries of the permit. That's what the intended use of the sign was, not to limit access.
And when operators are farming or grazing land that's in the mine site, who determines? Certainly they have access then to get on there and do their crop work or check their cattle and those types of things, but who determines who all they can bring on to help with their projects or to hunt or those types of things?
Oh, any lands that on an annual basis, our landowners are notified what lands that we're going to be using. And wherever we're operating, of course, there's general public can't come on to active mining operations or in the vicinity of those. Now, in the events of farmer access, typically we allow landowners who are farming lands to come fairly close to our operations, or at least to the farming limits that we've established. You know, we set up routes or trails so that they know where to go and that sort of thing. But general public can't get inside of our mining operations.
Okay, and regarding the land swap discussions, sometimes in your mining operations there are land swaps, as I understand it, and sometimes not. So sometimes you own the land that's being mined already, and sometimes it's the previous owner. Is that all complete, really separate of the actual coal lease agreement as far as the PSC mine approval?
Yes, and you know, contractually it's two separate agreements. If the swap occurs, our surface and coal lease agreement that was negotiated has all the terms and provisions necessary to compensate the surface owner and the coal owners through the life of the mining operations. Gives the company all the rights to use the property, sets out the consideration, et cetera. Some of our operations, we do purchase lands in advance. In some instances, the leases are older leases and don't have the surface production loss provisions that our newer leases have. And like in the case of Coyote Creek leases, they were drafted to make sure that the surface owners were compensated as if we didn't mine the land, so that they've got, you know, payments during mining operations and after mining operations if we were still using the land. In our other operations, most of our lands are purchased, and it's all a matter of economics. Is it, you know, more economical to operate the land owned in fee, or is it more economical to purchase the land in advance? Typically, the most of the ones that we push real hard to purchase are occupied buildings, you know, that are surrounded by mining operations, which are typically the ones that are most concentrated on.
So when on lands that you've purchased in your other mining operations, do the lands that have been purchased have the exact same reclamation standards as the lands that are still owned by the original owner? Or are there sometimes contractual deals where something specific is done on certain parcels to meet the landowner's wishes?
That might be going a little bit out of my expertise on. It's all covered under the landowner preference statements. You know, the reclamation standards are what they are. But the operations, each landowner submits a landowner preference statement, so that I know there are special provisions that PSC will approve, public service commissioners will approve, to allow some changes in land uses if the landowner wants them, if they want fences or certain things installed after reclamation. Those types of special provisions are accounted for.
And does your permit limit the amount of slope on the hills? Is that what we heard last week? Or in rougher terrain, like Mr. Voigt's, is that going to be similar terrain when it's done, or are you limited in how steep that can be?
I think that just past the line, that question is probably more easily or better answered by somebody who worked on the permit, put the permit stuff together. I think either Sarah Flath or probably be the one to answer that question.
Okay, no other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchuk?
Good morning, Mr. Melchior. Couple questions. First, I realize that we aren't involved in the lease negotiation, but I would like to better understand the paragraph 8 or section 8, where you talk about how the company reimburses the leasee for losses. So can you just kind of walk through, like, how does that actually work in a mining operation in terms of the land that is being mined and isn't being mined, and how you might be reimbursing them in a real-world situation?
Sure. I think you've got to take Section 3 and Section 8 in combination. The second paragraph, well, take the first paragraph. The first paragraph in Section 8 provides for damages to growing crops, equipment, anything that's surface improvements that are done or caused by our operations on the premises when we do exploration, drilling, those sorts of things, is covered under the first paragraph of 8. Once we start mining...
And that's so before actual mining. Before anything that your equipment or your operations causes damages, how do you determine what the damages are? Is that just like a mutual agreement?
Depending on, typically it would be drilling damages because we have to punch a lot of holes out there to meet the requirements under the permit. So typically it's damages related to loss of grass or hay lands, or in some cases actually crop damage where we'll go in and destroy some growing crops, wheat, corn, whatever. Some cases there's compaction damages. In rangelands, there's could be loss of grass for a couple of years. Typically the ground is cleaned up, the holes are cleaned up, they're reseeded, but the grass doesn't come back overnight, so there's typically maybe some damages that are paid more than once on a site for 2 years, maybe 3 years. That's your typical drilling damages. Now, once we give notice that we're going to start mining a piece of land, the second paragraph of Section 8 and Section 3 trigger in. Section 3A provides for a surface royalty and a coal royalty. The coal owner gets so many cents per ton, and the surface owner gets so many cents per ton, which is Section 3B.
Mm-hmm.
So if we go in and start mining the property, and we come in, say, 2 or 3 years in advance, or we use a piece of ground to pile topsoil, subsoil, build a pond, those are lands that are used before we actually mine coal. So they would get paid under the first provisions of the second paragraph, where it provides that before the commencement of actual coal removals operations, which are defined in the lease as taking the topsoil off, subsoil off, and digging down to the coal. That is coal removal operations. So if any of the lands are used before that actually happens, we pay loss of income.
Okay.
Once we start taking coal out of the ground, the surface royalty kicks in, where there's surface royalty paid for loss of use of that land. After mining operations, coal removal operations are over and the land's reclaimed, it goes into our productivity period, the 10-year bonding period, where the surface royalty covers that. If we use any of the property after coal removal operations for a haul road or keep a stockpile on it, or there's pieces of the lands that are not usable, there's loss of agricultural income on that one also. Now, as soon as the lands are reclaimed and restored during the bond productivity period, the landowner can graze cattle as soon as the lands are, the grass is growing sufficient enough to graze cattle. The landowner, in conjunction with the company, grazes that land to start the productivity, the proof of productivity of the property itself.
And then what's the payment? How do you calculate losses that in that time period?
It's based on loss of net income.
Okay.
So it's intended to provide compensation that's based on what the agricultural markets are in a given year. So if the adjoining lands are getting 50 bushels an acre and we got cropland that are 50, that's basic the documentation that you would use to support whatever that payment is.
And how do you account for what Mr. Voigt feels is higher productivity in certain areas? Are you paying for the losses on his kind of historic productivity in that area or land next to it that might not have been as productive, you know, over the course of time?
The loss of productivity of the land, we've got, you know, the lease itself does not provide for losses in productivity during the bonding period. Once the land is reseeded, it's not going to produce the same yields the first year of reclamation or the second or third. There's a 10-year period in there where you prove productivity. The landowner and company need to work, in his case, with grazing, will have to figure out, you know, at the time, how many heads of cattle, cow-calf pairs can go on a particular piece of land, you know, to graze it to what it needs to be grazed.
So you said it was loss of income then?
Loss of net income. Productivity.
And based on what are you referring to then? Income from the adjoining areas?
So it assumes if we're using the land for mining operations before or after, productivity is you know, not a factor. It's a whatever the income is lost from based on similar lands that are undisturbed that are close by.
Do you are you comfortable that is going to cover the potential losses that Mr. Voigt is going to be experiencing on this land? Based on what he's making today?
Yes.
In that post-bond?
I mean, the surface royalties and the loss of income, he will be adequately compensated.
Okay. The other area I wanted to talk to you about is the reclamation practices, and I realize you have experts that are coming after you. But just as the president, I want to get your overall thoughts and perspectives on your company's approach. In his letter to us, Mr. Voigt laid out some concerns about the company's practices in general and saying that they're inadequate, they've never been changed, that you've been informed of shortcomings by soil scientists, complaints from landowners. You've got employees that admitted you've got shortcomings. They'd like to do better, but there's a corporate culture that won't allow it. And since you're the head, I'd like to hear your approach on that and hear more about how you set the tone for your employees on reclamation and standards and improvements.
North American's corporate culture hasn't changed since we started operating in North Dakota. North American Coal has been and will continue to always be committed to reclaiming the land to as good or better condition as existed before we got there. Some lands that we reclaim initially, they do not. If you're reclaiming cropland and you put the topsoil on this year, you're probably not going to get the same yields the next year. That's why the PSC standards, the reclamation standards, provide for a 10-year period to prove this productivity, knowing that it's not going to be as good the first year, the second year, the third year. So there's a period of time that's given there to allow the company and the landowner to get this productivity up to where it was before. And our company has been committed to that in the past, and we continue to be committed to it.
Can you give me examples of your commitment? Like, how are you seeking to improve these processes over time and not just doing things the way they've always been done?
I know operationally there's things that we've done with regard to subsoil placement and those sorts of things. But again, I'm couldn't detail those in any
right.
professional manner. But we are always committed to work with the PSC under the reclamation standards to adopt improvements that come up. We're certainly not reclaiming the same way right now or that we were back in 1980. There are things that through experience and change of methods that become better. And we expect by the time Mr. Voigt's lands be mined and reclaimed, I'm sure there's going to be other standards out there and documentation on how to do things better than we're doing them today.
Mm-hmm. Do you I lost my thought. Well, maybe it'll come back to me after Brian asks his questions. I got distracted by the cell phone. Sorry. One more thing, and that came up from earlier, Mr. Voigt's testimony. He said that you misrepresented what was in the lease, and that he was told that he'd be reimbursed for all losses, and that he feels that was misrepresented. Can you tell me what you think is the source of that? Why he feels like he's not going to be compensated for all the losses, and you feel like he, you know, it's pretty clear in the contract, and he will be. You're confident that he will be.
I'm confident he will be. We spent, you know, with Mr. Voigt and his attorney. I know we spent quite a bit of time going through these provisions.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's hard to settle damages before they occur. You know, the intent is to compensate Mr. Voigt fully for his loss of damages before mining operations and after. You know, it's real difficult to ascertain, you know, how we're going to do it when I don't know what they are yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I generally. There is methods to compensate while coal is coming out of the ground, if we use lands before we take coal out of the ground, and if we use lands after we take. So the basics are here to provide for damages before and after actual coal comes out of the ground.
Okay. When it comes to reclamation standards. Some of the scientists that testified offered some new approaches and some things that might help improve productivity sooner. If these things aren't required by the PSC, does your company look at implementing them anyway, or what's the approach for those kinds of things that aren't necessarily required but might impact the performance and get you out of bond release on time or sooner? What's your company's attitude towards that?
If there are better ways to do things, our company is wide open to that. You know, we do operate under the requirements of the PSC. So any change in methods would have to be approved. So, you know, if improvements come around that make it better to reclaim a piece of land different than what we're doing it today to make it more productivity better, certainly you would look at it. You know, there's economics, of course, play into it to an extent. You know, there's, you know, sky's not the limit.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's ways to do things better than we're doing them now, I would think the PSC would want to adopt them, and so would we.
And another thing that Mr. Voigt said was that the reclamation practices are ineffective and result in lost income. And if that's true, what's going to be the result for Mr. Voigt?
Could you repeat the question? And
it was he stated that the reclamation practices are ineffective and it's going to result in lost income for him. How can you refute that?
Well, if there's lost income before we start, you know, taking coal out of the ground, he's compensated for loss of net income under Section 8 of the lease. If we're mining the land, the surface royalty is intended to replace, in Mr. Voigt's case, his cattle proceeds for those acres. And likewise, after mining, if he cannot graze as many cattle as he did before because we're using the land for ponds and haul roads, we have to compensate him for that. But while we're mining the land, there's a surface royalty that's being paid per ton for every ton coming up that compensates him for his loss of his agricultural income. Mm-hmm. During our mining operations, his agricultural's income is going to be diminished to a certain extent, and it's the intent that the royalties and the loss of net income replace that net income that he would otherwise receive for agricultural purposes.
Okay. And then my last question is, when it comes to changing and improving reclamation standards, who's responsible for that? Is the PSC ultimately supposed to be doing that? Is it a combination? Tell me how you view that.
The way I view it, I do not work, you know, on a day-to-day basis with the PSC staff, but I know, you know, our environmental people at all our operations work very closely with PSC staff, and I think there's been changes to the standards over years, either recommended by the companies or by the staff based on what's happening in the field. And I'm sure based on our company's practices that work cooperation will continue. And if there are better ways to improve those standards, I would think that jointly the companies and the PSC, with input from landowners, they're the ones that are out there, those practices would be adopted, I would hope anyway.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Kolk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Jim, for your testimony today. Just a couple questions. The way I read the lease is that December of 2010 is when it was signed. And then January of 2011, it was notarized. Is that the way you read it as well?
The lease itself is dated December 29th, 2010. It's effective as of that day. And it was signed by the Voigts on January 5th of 2011.
Right, and then notarized and filed in the appropriate county.
And it was signed by the company on January 7th of 2011, but it's dated effective as of December 29th of 2010.
And you've talked, and I think both sides agree that, at least I haven't heard anything different, that Mr. Voigt was represented by an attorney. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you know who that attorney was?
Yes.
Could you give his or her name? I don't think that's a trade secret. It's something we could find. I would just be curious who it is.
It was the Donovan Law Firm in Hazen.
Okay. So if that ever became an issue, someone could easily prove that. I haven't heard the other side, if you will, disagree that Mr. Voigt was represented. I just wanted to get that name on the record. Then we jump forward to May of 2014. When you said that you received information about a land swap, what was the discussion, if any, between January of 2011 when the lease was notarized up until May of 2014 about this lease?
I know there were discussions on, you know, the manors or the lands that we were going to be disturbing. We had a couple landowner meetings with the landowners to show them our plans. So most of the discussions were centered around our using the lands and how they would impact the landowners in that area, not only the Voits but the other landowners. There's one other large family that owns a lot of land up there.
Sure, and maybe I should have asked the question a different way. Of when did you first become aware that the allegations that there was sleight of hand in this lease, if you will? When did you first hear about that? I'm not saying it's true or false. I'm just asking when you first heard about that allegation.
The day of the first hearing.
All right. Thank you. That's the only question that I have.
Mr. Biella, any follow-up?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Broughton?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Melgear, I'd like to go back to paragraph 8 of Exhibit 1, the coal lease. We've been talking about that damages provision and the other. I want to make sure I'm understanding. So post-exploration, after you're actually done mining, you're saying that there is compensation for loss of income during the 10-year revegetation period?
No, that's not what I said.
Okay, can you explain to me if there is any compensation for loss of income during that revegetation period to the landowner?
No, there's no loss of income on the lands that are reclaimed. The loss of income would be for lands utilized at subparagraph, it's in the third line of the second paragraph, if after completion of mining operations, if we utilize any of the lands after coal removal to in conjunction with our mining operations on adjoining lands, those lands are loss of income is paid on those properties.
Okay. So can you explain to me or give me an example of what you mean when you say that you're using land in conjunction with mining operations on other lands?
The most common would be a haul road.
Okay.
To get the coal, you've got to go through parcels of land as you mine them. You've got to haul the coal out. So that's typically the land uses. And then with the haul road, you've the topsoil and the subsoil that is required to reclaim that haul road will be piled somewhere. There's got to be water management to take care of runoff. So those are those types of acreages that are utilized for those purposes will be compensated based on loss of income.
Okay, and so if there's a field that is in the 10-year reclamation period and you are planting it, trying to improve productivity, and Mr. Boyd is using that field and getting decreased yields during that period, there's no compensation under the coal lease for that?
Yes, there is. It's the surface royalty payment itself under Section 3 is compensation for the use of the surface during the normal mining operations.
We're talking about paragraph 3, subparagraph B, correct?
I believe so. Yes.
And the 12 cents per ton of coal, is that tied to any actual damages suffered by the landowner?
No, I don't. You can... It's based on a per tonnage basis. I would suspect it would be more than actual damages.
And do you know that for a fact?
Pretty confident it is.
Okay. And in this situation, the landowner owns both the surface and the coal underneath. Is that right?
It varies on, we've got title reports on each one of his tracts. I know he and his family, his siblings own a portion of the coal under there, and the prior owner's heirs, I think, own some also. So it's split between the Voigt family and the family that owned it before.
Do you know what a split estate is?
Oh, yes.
Okay, can you tell me what that is briefly?
It's where the surface or minerals are severed from the surface estate to create a separate mineral estate.
And so in this lease, there's a 15 cents per ton royalty for the minerals and a 12 cents per ton royalty for the surface. If North American has a situation with an owner who owns just the minerals, would they still be receiving only a 15% per ton royalty, or would that per ton royalty be greater?
Depends on where you're at. At the Coyote Creek mine, it's 15 cents a ton.
Okay.
I think this lease, I think, is escalated. There's a 3% escalator in it. So, you know, depending on when you sign the lease, it might, it'll be fractions of a penny difference, but for the most part, it's all intended to be the same.
But if Mr. Voigt, for example, didn't own the surface, he would only be receiving 15 cents per ton as compensation under the lease?
Based on his undivided interest.
There was some discussion of landowner preferences, and this was in conjunction with the discussion of the instances where the coal company might buy the land in fee simple. If the coal company does buy the land in fee simple, would they have the choice then to change the post-mine land use if that were approved by the PSC?
The post-mine land use has got to be, you know, the company just couldn't arbitrarily change it. It's got to be approved by the Public Service Commission, and it's got to be approved by the county itself. The land use, the county commission ultimately.
And if the coal company were not the surface owner also would have to approve that?
Excuse me, could you repeat the question?
If the coal company didn't own the surface of the land, the surface owner would also have to approve that post-mine land use change?
Yes. Yep.
There was some discussion about the general reclamation practices at North American, and you stated that it's your policy to put the land in as good or better condition as it was before mining. Is that right?
That is correct.
And you also stated that you're wide open to better ways of conducting reclamation. Is that right?
Yes, we consider those.
Okay. And so if the PSC found that putting specific conditions on a permit would result in more successful reclamation of the land, you wouldn't be opposed to that?
Not if it was economically feasible to do it.
And you were present at the time that the coal lease was signed with Mr. Voigt. Is that right?
That's correct.
And you indicated that he was represented by, I believe his name is Patrick Donovan. Is that right?
I didn't say the name, but it was Patrick Donovan.
Did Mr. Voigt or Mr. Donovan on his behalf make any changes to the coal lease before signing it?
Well, I don't remember if I know there was just letters going back and forth, but I can't. I would suspect that words had to be changed some places, but I couldn't say right off the top of my head, no.
So you don't know?
No, I'd have to look in the file.
After you had the meeting at which the coal lease was signed, and up until the date of the first hearing in this matter, how many conversations did you have with Mr. Boyd?
Boy, I couldn't put a number on it, you know, 3, 4, 5. I know we've talked on the phone mostly, a few meetings.
That's all I have.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
We have no questions. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Chrisman?
You mentioned a couple of times damages and working with the landowners and reaching an agreement on what they should be. Mm-hmm. So not specifically Coyote Creek, since they haven't gotten started yet, but North American's other operations, you deal with dozens or maybe hundreds of landowners over the years. There's got to be some times where you can't reach agreement, I would think. What's the fallback position? Is that something that if it can't be reached, an agreement reached mutually, that it goes to district court, or does it come to the PSC, or what's the fallback?
Well, in my 39 years, it's never happened. So I would guess, not a lawyer, so I don't know what the process would be. But I'm sure there is a legal process to doing it. But you know, we've always been able to settle them. You know, if two reasonable people in the same room, you should be able to settle it.
Okay. Other questions,
Commissioner Fedorchuk?
I'm sorry to belabor this, but I want to go back again because now after Mr. Broughton's questions, I'm confused again. In terms of the compensation to the landowner for losses, pre-mining, you go out there, you disturb anything, you pay damage for loss of productivity.
Loss of income.
Loss of income based on productivity.
No, based on adjoining lands.
That's pre-mining.
Pre-mining, yes. If you use undisturbed lands as the basis, similar undisturbed. So if we're using a acre of cropland, mm-hmm. that we took out of agricultural production, and there's an acre of cropland that the landowner owns next door that he got 50 bushels an acre on it of wheat, that would be the basis to determine that loss of income.
And then during mining, it's the royalties.
The royalties, yes.
Then the area that I'm most confused about is during the post-bond or bonding period, time period, where you're, you know, the land's been reclaimed and the grass is growing back. In our conversation, I thought you said that there was some payment to the landowner during that time period, but then during Mr. Broughton's conversation with you, I thought differently. So tell me what happens during that time period where you know the land isn't as productive as it's the goal is. So the farmer, or in this case Mr. Voigt, isn't making as much as he would have pre-mining. How do you compensate him during that time period?
When the land is being reclaimed, the surface royalty is the compensation for the loss of land use on a acre of land that's just used for mining. You go in and you take the topsoil off, you mine it, so you get paid a surface royalty during the mining, which covers the loss of agricultural income for the period of time during which it's mined and during the normal reclamation period.
So that's the 12 cents or the 15 cents?
12
that's
cents.
That's the 12 cents.
Plus the 15 cents is paid, too, if he owns a portion of the coal.
But there wouldn't be any coal produced then because they're done mining. So it's just the 12 cents during the post-mining.
12 cents and the 15 cents are paid exactly at the same time. It's based on coal as it's mined from the ground. It's paid within quarterly
based
on production.
I'm talking about there's no mining anymore, so there's no coal coming out. The land is being has been reclaimed and the grass is growing again, so there's no coal coming from that land. How are they compensated
They're compensated based on the surface royalty they received, which will be considerably more than the agricultural income during that mining period.
So they continue to receive that, or they received it? So they're compensated a bunch. They're compensated, your view is they're compensated more than what they're losing during the actual mining period, and that carries over for the post-mining pre-bond release time period?
Yes, basically they're compensated upfront.
I see.
For those, if that's the right way to put it.
And is there a negotiation process in coming up with the 15 or 12 cents? That process, is that negotiated? Does the land, they can obviously not sign the lease, and so that's their ultimate power. But do landowners sketch it out and figure out, like, this is how much I can make, and, this is how much I'm going to be making, it this works or doesn't? What's that process? Can they say, we want 17 cents, we want 15 cents, we want 20 cents?
Yes, it's the negotiation process in the beginning. Exactly how we came to those numbers, they ultimately are negotiated. But at the Coyote Creek mine, we were, once we had the majority of the landowners signing leases at that rate, we're fortunate enough, maybe is a better word, that nearly all the leases in that area are substantially the same royalty rates.
And what if it takes longer than 10 years to get the land back to production? Is there any compensation or the production from prior mining? So is there any compensation to the landowner then, or are they still relying on kind of the upfront payment that you described?
If there's circumstances that at that time that were there was a inability to prove productivity, that would have to be done at the time. If something like that occurs, but I would certainly hope that it wouldn't. Yeah, it would have to be addressed at the time, but it's intended, the lease itself sets the basis for it, I think.
Okay. And again, the elements of the lease are not something we have any authority over or jurisdiction. I just wanted to better understand how Mr. Boyd is being compensated. So, all right. Thank you, Jim.
Commissioner Kolk?
No, Your Honor. Okay.
Mr. Biel, anything further?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Broughton?
Yes, Your Honor. Sorry, Commissioner Fedorchuk's questions now brought a couple more up for me. Following on that discussion, Mr. Melchior, the assumption in the lease, or your assumption, is that once you're done mining, you are going to have the land fully reclaimed and released from bond within 10 years.
It's 10 years, from the time it's reclaimed, there's a 10-year bonding period. So it's not from the time we take acre one off, it's not going to be released from bond 10 years after we take topsoil off. So it's probably going to be closer to the 12 to 15-year thing on a normal acre.
The goal, at least, would be that once you have the coal out and you start putting the subsoil and the topsoil back, that from that point on you would be finished with reclamation and release from bond within 10 years?
Yeah, should be.
And so the surface royalty is intended to compensate based on the assumption that you're going to have that reclamation completed and have the productivity back within those 10 years?
Yes, you could figure it that way, yes.
And if you had land that you didn't prove productivity on and was not released from bond for, let's say, 20 years, there would be no obligation under the lease to pay any additional compensation?
Not the basis, I think, is there. You know, during that productivity period, the landowner is going to be using the land. You know, I suspect the productivity is not going to be zero. You know, so, you know, if there is a difference between, you know, what the adjoining lands are at 100% and the reclaimed lands at 90%, if there's a deficiency in there, you can, you know, that would have to be addressed at the time if it's an extended period beyond normal.
But that adjustment isn't anything that you're obligated to do under the lease?
Certainly not in black and white, no.
If a surface owner didn't own any minerals, would they still get a lease that gave them a surface royalty?
Yes.
Okay, that's all I have.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
Yes, this discussion prompted one or two questions. What is your understanding of the role of the lease as it relates to the PSC's jurisdiction for permitting and reclamation?
In order for a company to get a mining permit, you have to have 75% of the coal estate leased or controlled, either in lease or fee, and you have to have surface owner consent. So you, in order for the PSC to allow the land to be permitted, you've got to have surface owner consent.
So the company applying for a permit has to submit proof of the right to mine and the right to use the surface for 75% at least.
That is correct. That is correct.
Are you aware of any involvement of PSC jurisdiction with lease terms and or compensation?
None.
Thank you.
Commissioner Chrisman?
None.
Commissioner Fedorchak? Commissioner Kalk? Okay. Mr. Biela, did you have anything else?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Melchior. You can step down. I think we'll take about a 10-minute break before you call your next witness, Mr. Biela.